Good morning.
Good morning.
I will take that as a praise offering to Jesus. That is wonderful. I live outside of Washington, D.C., and I have been overwhelmed and amazed. It has been years. I cannot remember the last time I spoke in a church, as sad as that may be. When Catherine Rott asked me a year ago if I would come to Oklahoma, I said, I would love to come to Oklahoma. I have family here. I'm not a stranger to Oklahoma. I have two sisters, one in Owosso and one in Tulsa. But I had never had the opportunity to meet other Oklahomans. So I applaud all of you. In the D.C. area, there is not a hunger for truth, let alone a hunger for even Jesus. It's a very, very hardcore liberal left area. And so I am thrilled that I can share with you the knowledge, the discernment, the understanding that God has given me. I have not done anything extraordinary, truly. I have gone where God has led me. I have gone where He has opened the doors. And I have been there because He has provided and He has allowed me to cover, give or take, 5 meetings, about 88 global meetings around the world in every continent with the exception of Asia. So you just pray for me that one of these days I'll go to Asia. I have found, as I have covered the global level, that God has a sense of humor. You know, He's playing chess up there. You know, He's playing chess. And I have been in so many instances where it becomes absolutely comical against all the evil and the orchestrations and the manipulations of these evil people. And I just watch how God orchestrates. And He is in control. I am grateful for each one of you, for the hunger of your heart, for the desire to learn. We cannot affect society. We cannot change legislation unless we understand the agenda. My goal this morning, we're going to be talking 3, maybe 3.5 hours. And so, I have designed this to take a look at the United Nations and the global infrastructure, the Biological Diversity Treaty, known as Smart Growth. You here in Tulsa are right smack dab in the middle of a major Smart Growth initiative. So we're going to help you understand a little bit more. We're going to be talking about the global economics, your money, their money maybe, global players, what we are up against, the power of money, those who have it, and how they're using it. And you may not know all those names. You know, I haven't talked about Hillary. Do I need to? No. But I'm going to show you other people, and you're going to start getting a profile of the inner core that is controlling, orchestrating, financing, and leading a very evil, it is more than Orwellian, it is really an anti-God, anti-Christian agenda designed to wipe him off the face of the earth. They don't know Scripture very well, do they? No. And lastly, we're going to talk about how we live in world government. World government is not coming. It is here. It has been here. And so we need to recognize it. Why? So that we can pray and we can ask God to show us how to stand. It is the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man and woman that avails much. Oh, dear Lord, please wipe these evil people off the face of the earth. Just won't do it. Okay? Just won't do it. So, before I begin, let me say that most of what I'm going to be discussing today, I've written about in the form of newsletters, in the form of pamphlets, in the form of reports. There are a couple of items and a couple CDs that are free. Please avail yourself of them. I have a report on smart growth and how it was passed and what happened in the state of Maryland. We were the first state to pass it. I have, besides my two books, this report, Sustainable Development, The Greatest Lie of the 21st Century. Very, very important. It is an extension of my other writings and soon to be published in a book. And so with that, let's talk about the information at hand. We're going to understand the powers, players, and agenda of world government, the major players, biological diversity, global economics, and a spiritual response. As I mentioned, I've written two books. The first one is Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince. It talks about his role behind the scenes, a very hidden role that the media is not reporting on. It was the first book to explain sustainable development, and it was the first book to explain public-private partnership, which is the reordering of government in the world. My second book is the United Nations Global Straitjacket. It is an overview of world government. Bill Clinton's Reinventing Government, which is the acceptance of the practice of establishing public-private partnership throughout the government and throughout our country. And it explains the global legal and philosophical roles of world government. So we're going to understand the power structures and players today. There is a gentleman, H.G. Wells. You will remember him. He was a major socialist. And he said, a man's socialist desire must be keen enough to actually prefer spending 2 or 3 days a night speaking and debating or picking up social information, even in the most dingy way. It is at such lecturing and debating work and on squalid little committees and ridiculous little delegations to conferences that the ordinary Fabian workman or clerk. Now, H.G. Wells was a Fabian socialist. Fabian socialism says we agree, we believe, and we support all of the tenets of communism. Now, communism says let's go in and do it overnight. You know, surprise, here we are. While Fabian socialism says let's do it slowly. Let's change how people think. Let's change laws. Let's change the structure of government. So H.G. Wells is saying, here the Fabian workman or clerk must qualify for, look at that, his future seat on town council, the school board, or perhaps the cabinet. While you and I have been living life and enjoying life, there are those who have a different agenda. And their agenda is nothing but a transfer of wealth, the wiping out of Christianity, what we believe, and lastly, controlling. Controlling us, controlling the world's assets. So let's take a look here. We're going to be discussing some of the power players here and there. It took me about 4 years to put this together. I had a lot of trouble. You know, it's not like anybody had this chart anywhere. All of the information that I am presenting basically has been by very hard research. And little by little, I have glued it together. God has given me the information and the discernment to do that. So, on the top screen, you will see this is the finance. And we'll be talking about this when we get to the global economics. We have the International Organization of Stock Exchanges, the Bank for International Settlements, and something called the IAIS. The International Organization of Security Commissions, IOSCO, on the left, is like a United Nations of stock exchanges. Now, when I realized this, I was absolutely flabbergasted. You and I know about the United Nations meeting and ambassadors that go there, but did you know that for every single one of these organizations that I am showing you here, they have their own United Nations Parliament. And so all the stock exchange commissioners from all over the world meet. IOSCO was in Montreal and they have moved to Spain. And they meet yearly looking to set up and harmonize the stock exchanges and everything having to do with money and stocks and bonds and the whole infrastructure, which we'll see in number 3. And so that's what they've been doing. The Bank for International Settlements, many of you may know, is the apex of where all the central banks meet in the United States, excuse me, in the world. And we are going to be taking a look at that in three as well. The other one, the International Organization of Security Commissions, basically stands for the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. Currently, every state in the union has an insurance supervisor. However, most of the other countries in the world only have one. It's like a national supervisor for insurance. And what our government is looking to do at this moment is to change that and have a national insurance regulator. So they're busy harmonizing here, there, and everywhere. Then below that is the group of eight. These are the top eight industrialized countries plus Russia that make up and comprise part of the United Nations. When you take out the group of eight from the United Nations, that leaves 183 there. Smashed in between are major non-governmental organizations that are affecting change. The International Chamber of Commerce, the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, the World Economic Forum, the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers. We will see these in the Global Players, which is number four today. Then you have the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, UNESCO. You're probably very familiar with the United Nations Education, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. There they are changing how you and I think. And the last one is UNTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. That's where multinational, transnational corporations meet. This is just an overview. This does not include everything. We're just literally giving you a thumbnail sketch. John F. Kennedy said on July 4th, 1962, "I will say here and now and on this day of independence that the U.S. will be ready for a declaration of interdependence." This is the first time this word was ever heard. It was shocking that an American president should talk about interdependence. My goodness, what was that? "That we will be prepared to discuss with a united Europe." 1962. Is this prophecy from a president? "With a united Europe, the ways of forming a concrete Atlantic partnership." Bill Clinton said in 2003, "Instead of globalization, which is the process of tearing down the borders between nation states, I prefer the term interdependence." Do we see something here? We cannot escape each other. The challenge that will dominate the next few decades is to move this world of ours from interdependence. Here we are, another major giant step, to an integrated community with shared values, shared beliefs, and shared responsibilities. You see, unless you can identify their words, it will mean nothing when you hear them. And so what we are starting to see is that underneath our noses, in front of our eyes, Bill Clinton was explaining world government. How many people understood? This is the world before 1945. If you took a look at America, we had a number of barriers that separated us and our country from all the other countries of the world. They were economic, political, trade, legal and judicial, military and intelligence, and international finance. The process of creating world government involves tearing down the barriers between nation states. The economic barriers between the nation states fell in 1944 with the establishment of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The political barriers fell in 1945 with the establishment of the United Nations. The trade barriers fell in 1994 with the establishment of the World Trade Organization. You also see NAFTA up there because that was passed as well by our Congress. That was a busy year. That was Bill Clinton's first year, you all will recall. No, that was his second term. The international financial architecture was set in place. It's too really complex for us to discuss between 1995 and 2005, but they've been changing all the rules and regulations to integrate a world financially, not only with the stock exchanges, but with insurance and banking. The legal and judicial barriers fell in 1998 with the creation of the International Criminal Court. And we're going to discuss most of these. We're going to leave the IMF World Bank for lecture number 3. And then, as you can see, when you take a look at all the barriers that fell before, the military and the intelligence, the black area, that really constituted most of the barriers. The military and the intelligence was the most sensitive. How in the world could you completely integrate the world into a world governmental structure unless you also find a way to tear down the military and the intelligence barriers? And so, 9/11, whether you think it was planned and managed or a true accident, fit the bill. So that puts us into a new time in the world. We are now in the international level. All the barriers are down, and so we now have not domestic law, but international law that is truly ruling the world. Let's take a look. For example, when we take a look at the United Nations, what do we have? We have a General Assembly. We have a global governing political structure. On the left-hand side, we talk about the role of the heads of state. When the heads of state meet, which is every 5 years at the UN, it is called a summit. So in 2000, they had the Millennium Summit, which called for a complete reordering and restructuring of the UN. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then on a yearly basis, the ambassadors meet in the General Assembly. Now, there's something I want you to see. Whenever the World Trade Organization holds a meeting, all of the trade representatives from all over the world are meeting. They're basically having their own little United Nations, but it's on trade. When the International Monetary Fund meets, all the Treasury secretaries from around the world are meeting. They're doing the same thing. It is a mini UN meeting on finance. When the food ministers meet at the, I don't know if you know, there's a World Food Organization, FAO, in Rome. I've been there. All the agriculture ministers from around the world are meeting. And labor, when the International Labor Organization, the ILO, meets, all of the secretaries of labor. When the Security Council meets, there are 5 secretaries of state because they comprise the Security Council. They are meeting. And habitat means homes, housing. All the health and human services secretaries are meeting. So what am I saying? I am saying that a UN parliamentary structure is happening all across the board. Now, let's put it in a different light. I was sitting at my desk one day, and I said, I wonder how I can relate the structure of the United Nations to the governmental structure here in the United States. And so I sat down, and what you have there is the cabinet level, the executive level of our government, with all the different cabinets and then the president and vice president. So I began drawing lines. This is what it looks like. When you take a look at our executive level, there is a corresponding department or cabinet or organization on the international level that basically comprises a global governmental structure. We are in a world without borders, an integrated and interdependent world. James Wolfensohn, who was the president of the World Bank until Wolfensohn got in just recently, said this: will we have the courage and the leadership to reach out? Will we finally recognize that we live in one world? Look around. We are linked by financial systems. We are linked by communications. We are linked by environment. We are linked by trade. Migration knows no borders. Crime knows no borders. Drugs, war, and peace know no borders. We need leadership to explain to our people that our national interests are international. When we take a look at the actors in an integrated world, we're going to start with the United Nations. Now, this is a card that I got that celebrated the 50th anniversary of the United Nations, which was formed in 1945 in San Francisco. Alger Hiss was the first United Nations Secretary General. The people in the United Nations don't want to recognize this because it was proven that he was a communist. He wasn't sentenced for being a communist, but for lying to Congress. The United States Constitution, when we start taking a look at the real structure that's happening, our rights come from God. They are inalienable. They cannot be taken away. We have a republican form of government with property rights, individual liberty, and supposedly limited government. Now, let's take a look at where they want to bring us. The United Nations Charter, as I mentioned, it's based on the Russian Constitution. What does that say to you? Our rights come from government, not God. They are limited, not unlimited, and they can be taken away for behavior or speech. It is a feudalistic form of government for the common good, eliminating the individual. If the UN is the organizing mechanism for bringing all nations under its jurisdiction, then basically that mechanism is a merger with communism. Do I think we're seeing communism in America? Absolutely. Rules, regulations, control. The United Nations has a head of state, a governing body, a currency, its own currency called the Special Drawing Rights, a treasury system, the IMF World Bank, a court and legal system with the World Court and the International Criminal Court. It has its own policing mechanism, which we're going to take a look at, its own oath of allegiance, and as we mentioned, its own charter. They are in the process of passing, of getting countries to agree to a global tax. And we're going to talk a little bit later about a global currency. I would like for you to see what happened in the 1990s. Most of us weren't aware the United Nations was still operating in the 70s under total blackout. In the 1970s, they held a series of conferences just like the ones I have listed there. By the 1990s, they had their foundation in place, and they were building on it, and they were ready to make it public for you and I. And so in 1992, they unveiled at the Rio Earth Summit Agenda 21. We will be discussing that in segment number two. In 1994, that was the first global meeting that I covered. They were looking to reduce the population. Then the Social Summit in Copenhagen. In 1995, they were looking to empower the United Nations. Most of this has already been put in place. At the Fourth Women's Conference in Beijing, I did not go to that. Instead, I opted for the first Gorbachev State of the World Forum held that same month. And I think I made a good decision. In Beijing, I would have never been able to have gotten close to a lot of key higher-up movers and shakers, such as Mikhail Gorbachev and Maurice Strong. And then they had a meeting in Istanbul called Habitat 2, because the first one took place 20 years earlier, called Habitat 1 in Vancouver, British Columbia, that talks about basically smart growth. I will be attending the third Vancouver meeting next month. They never stop. They have meetings ad nauseum. They go on. They're endless. They have people from academia. They have most of the colleges and universities now, think tanks, all working on world government. You can't keep up with the number of reports, the number of ideas, the number of conferences. 10 years ago, I was told that they hold 5,000 conferences a year. Well, by now, I'm sure it's escalated. If you multiply, if you divide that by 365, we're talking, I think, if I remember my math, over 118 meetings a day, including holidays and Sunday, which they're not worried about. This is a picture of the General Assembly. This is literally a world parliament. It houses the representatives from all the nation states, 191. Now, every country, no matter the size, has one vote. They have equal weighting. So that means that the United States, the power of the United States, has one vote, just like Cuba or Andorra, which is the smallest country in the world, except the Commonwealth. And I have a paper out there reporting on what I'm going to tell you now. This is absolutely diabolically brilliant. And what is the United States doing, starting with Roosevelt? Playing second fiddle to Britain. I am not a lover of the key power movers in Britain. British people, they're fine. Not as fine as Americans. Now I'm taking the opposite of Cecil Rhodes, who said, if all the world were British because they're the finest race in the world, we wouldn't have any war. Well, as an American, a real red-blooded American, I disagree. The Commonwealth. The Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth, is comprised of 54 countries. You may recall that during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the Commonwealth decolonized. You will see that they did more than decolonize. Every time they spun off one of their countries or colonies, that country got a vote at the United Nations. That was a good deal. Just a good deal. If you think the queen or the king at that time, her father, let go of South Africa that has the largest deposit of gold and diamonds and said bye-bye, you know, I've got a bridge down the road I'd like to sell you. So let's take a look at this. The numbers in red represent the number of Commonwealth countries inside these global organizations. In other words, if they are voting at IOSCO or at the IAIS or at the Bank for International Settlements or at the Group of Eight or at the United Nations or at the World Trade or at the World Bank, we are outvoted. At the Group of Eight, we're outvoted by one extra vote, Canada. Now, is that not brilliant? Create an international level and then find a way to get more votes than anybody else or the potential of more votes, and you can outfox everybody else. And you know what? I showed this to a congresswoman. She was shocked. She said to me, "Can I show this report to other people?" I said, "Absolutely." I haven't heard anything yet. I went to the United Nations and I said, "Why is it that the Commonwealth can operate inside the United Nations?" The guy told me he didn't know what I was talking about, which I should have expected. Now, let's take a look down at the bottom. The Free Trade Areas of the Americas, FTAA. They have 13 potential votes. In other words, in our hemisphere, when they put us into a regional block, we will be outvoted by 13 Commonwealth countries in our hemisphere. The United Nations is consistently and constantly increasing their power. Henry Kissinger wrote a book called Does America Need a Foreign Policy? That's great from him, isn't that? And this actually was approved at the UN Millennium Summit in 2002. He said, non-interference in the domestic affairs of other states has been abandoned in favor of universal humanitarian intervention or universal jurisdiction. So let's break that down for a moment. The United Nations was set in place for countries to talk over their differences. Sounded logical to everybody. Okay, yeah, sounds good. We won't have war. Well, if anybody can tell me how many wars the UN has averted, I'd like for them to raise their hand. All right? Now, what are they saying here? They're saying, look at AIDS, look at starving children, look at the fact that we have all these failed states, which they've created, they've helped create them. We have dictators like Idi Amin. we have genocide happening in all these various countries, we now have to change our policy from protecting countries to protecting people. Humanitarianism. This way, the United Nations is now saying we need to shift our focus from countries to individuals. Can you imagine what would happen if Oklahoma decided to secede from the United Nations or any kind of jurisdiction or something like that? They might send their troops to protect peace. Now, by peace, I figured out they are not talking P-E-A-C-E. They are talking P-I-E-C-E, the whole peace. The Millennium Summit in 2000, they just had another summit in last September. But in 2000, this was very historic. The kings, the presidents, the princes, and prime ministers of this world. Now, let me stop there. We think in terms of presidents and prime ministers meeting or heads of state. There has been an increase in the last several years of the role and the position of royalty in world affairs. In fact, last year, King Juan Carlos of Spain made the speech on behalf of his country. Prince Albert of Monaco has also spoken there. Prince Rainier, who is now deceased, has spoken there, along with a number of Saudi Arabian sheikhs who continuously and constantly play a role at the United Nations. And while I am at it, the Holy See. How many of you people know that the Holy See is a country of its own? And as such, they have country status at the United Nations. So they're not exactly spiritual. And the question is, what percentage of the Holy See is spiritual and what percent is political? And I would not want to be in the back room. UN empowerments given in 2000. They strengthened international law. They added the ability for the United Nations to add an international House of Representatives. Currently, the United Nations has something with the ambassadors equal to our Senate. But now they have the ability in the future to, if it would work out or when time is ready, to have you and I elect, exciting, isn't that, our own UN representative. Now, tell me, did you read that in any of your newspapers? Did you hear that on ABC, NBC, BS? They gave the Secretary General, the Security Council, now here's what I was talking about, the ability to authorize action inside a sovereign state. They allowed the United Nations to add a form of global taxation, establish a rapid deployment force. That's called a defense department. I don't know, would you call them? No, maybe for them we'd call it war, okay? They call it peacekeeping. It just depends on your view. They also gave the United Nations trusteeship over the global commons, the space, the oceans, and the atmosphere. Now, let me explain that. I remember when I first heard the term global commons, like, duh, global commons? What in the world are they talking about? Well, the explorers, when they went exploring, found a country, even if the Indians were there, they found a country, they planted their flag. They said, this is my new find. This is mine. Well, that's exactly what the United Nations did in 2000. They said, you know what? Nobody has planted their flag in space or in the atmosphere or in the oceans other than the 100-mile national sovereignty that we have around each country. And so they took trusteeship over the global commons. Is that brilliant or is that brilliant? We now have to ask, who is the real power behind the United Nations? That's for next time I come. They then determined that they had to find a way to justify their position. And so they said, we are going to have a new mantra, new goals for the third millennium. And we want to reduce by 50% HIV/AIDS in the world. We want to help all the highly indebted poor countries, HIPC. They happen to be in Africa, most of them. And most of them just happen to be former British colonies. What a coincidence. We want to cut in half the number of people living in poverty who are hungry and lack access to clean water. And we want to give every child in the world basic primary education. Lastly, I add this one in because, you know, it just goes with the flow. We want to increase the lives of slum dwellers worldwide. They estimate, somehow, I don't know if they've gone and counted, you never know, 500 million slum dwellers, and their documents say that they have provided $50 to give every slum dweller $50 to improve his life. Don't laugh. Guess who's going to pay for this? We are going to do it somehow through taxation, global taxation, and more taxation. So what is the cost? They call this the Millennium Development Goals. You had better remember this phrase, Millennium Development Goals, MDGs. Why? You're going to be hearing about it for the rest of your life. Now, it would have been 50,000, we wish. We don't even wish that. 50 billion last year. Because of inflation, it's 66 billion this year. They estimate 150 billion a year by 2015. I think that would buy a lot of Big Macs. George Bush. Yeah, it sounds like Bill Clinton, though. What's the difference? Well, there's very little. That's right. Very little difference. America supports the International Development Goals and the United Nations Millennium Document. He said this in 2002, in March, right after, basically, he was elected. Oops, wrong one. Global taxation. Where and how has it come about? The idea started in March of 1995 at the Social Summit, which was my second conference. And that is where, before I had gone to that meeting, I figured out that they were going to try to broach the idea, first time in history, that the United Nations should be able to tax. From there, they went to the United Nations Millennium Summit in 2000. Then the Financing for Development meeting in 2002. Now, this was the first time in history that a conference solely for the ability of the United Nations to raise money through forms of taxation was ever held. Then at the IMF World Bank, see, it's going around the whole international structure here, it was in their documents for the 2004 meeting. The Group of Eight in June of 2004, Jacques Chirac at the Sea Island, Georgia summit put it on the agenda of the Group of Eight. Now we're really getting hot. Then at the World Economic Forum a year ago, Jacques Chirac again called for a tax for the poor. Then the Group of Eight meeting a year later, it was on their agenda. At the UN General Assembly, that was a summit meeting of heads of state, in September of 2005, they agreed to it. And in 12 of 05, just a couple months ago, France, of course, that's going to be their thing in history, France passed, their parliament passed, the ability for their government to add a 3, 5, 10 euro tax to airline tickets. Now, we are told that this money will go from the airlines, but they'll take their cut, to the government. And that will raise extra money for the government. And then, supposedly, the government will then somehow reappropriate it for the poor. So, yeah, right. Never happened. Because nobody's going to be able to monitor where all these monies go, you know. It'll just sort of get lost somewhere in some bank account. A Swiss, of course. You know, this becomes laughable. I said to Jacques Chirac a year ago at the G8 meeting in Scotland, I said, Mr. Chirac, if this tax on airline tickets goes well, do you have, or will you have, I wasn't being that forceful, do you have, will there be other forms of airline ticket taxes? And he said, oh, we have many more planned. Kofi Annan said, in the 21st century, I believe the mission of the United Nations will require us to look beyond the framework of states and beneath the surfaces of nations or communities. What are they doing here? They are changing the structure. Actual government is being plucked like a chicken. And they are moving it to something called multi-stakeholders. And we will get to that in Global Players. So, the actors above the nation state, UNESCO. Many of you are homeschoolers. I'm sure you're thoroughly familiar with UNESCO. That was set up in 1945 at the time of the United Nations. Huxley said this, "Do not wars, after all, begin in the minds of men? Since wars begin in the minds of men, it is the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed." UNESCO. This was a representative to the organizing meeting of UNESCO from England. The aim, she believed, was to replace nationalistic teaching by a conception of humanity that trains children to have a sense of mankind as well as of national citizenship, causing the state to be the cause for a progressive role in education instead of that jealous parent who will not allow outside interests to enter the home. This gave UNESCO a great international project for educating the peoples of peace in the spirit of peace. It was through education that the minds could be enlightened, knowledge inculcated, and critical judgment developed, thus barring the way to any ideology and any policy which sowed suspicion, discord, and hatred between individuals, peoples, nations that would lead to war. Now, let me say here that this really sets the stage for other people, like nationalists or religious people, or as the term has been used so many times, religious extremists, does it not? The goal for UNESCO is to promote peace, human rights, and international understanding based on humanism. This is very well understood today as we look at the product of what they have been doing, the products coming out of our schools. You may know that UNESCO launched the Associated Schools Project in 1953, and obviously, again, we are seeing what is happening there. Speaking of what you think, the United Nations has come up with what they call the four types of capital. The first is natural capital. Oil, gas, diamonds, gold, whatever is found in underneath the ground. The second is manufactured capital, buildings, roads, things like that. Third is you and I, human capital. And the fourth is social capital. That is how people think. Let's take a look at the Group of Eight. Who are they? The United Nations has 191 countries. And within the United Nations, you have the Group of Eight. The Group of Eight was started, for many of you, in 1972. It began, it had its beginning with President Nixon calling for a group of men to come together. This group of men became basically the designers of world government. Now, what is the Group of Eight? It is comprised. It started with five, then it went to seven, now it's eight. The countries of the United States, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, Great Britain, and Japan. And several years ago, Russia became a member. And so these countries, as they evolved, facilitated the process of globalization, which is tearing down the barriers between nation states. It acted as a global board of directors. It was initially for economic reasons only, but now they have gone into every area and every facet of national government, thus making it international. They have facilitated the entry of corporations as partners in helping governments. This is called public-private partnership. They support all the goals of the United Nations, and they gave a sanction for that War Department at the United Nations. It started off with 45,000 troops. They currently have 85,000 troops. These troops, even though they say they are there to keep peace in Africa, when I asked that question as to where they could go, they did admit that these troops can go anywhere in the world. Now, 2 years ago, or last year in Scotland, the Queen gave a dinner for the heads of state. This is the very first time this has happened, even though there have been several other G5, G7, G8, not a G8, but anyway, G7 conferences in Britain. So here she is with her Knights of the Round Table. Do you see anything that sticks out? Now, what did the Queen tell her knights? I decided that that was a very, very important question. So I asked Tony Blair in the closing press briefing, Mr. Blair, could you please tell me what the Queen told you all at dinner? And he looked at me and he sort of smirked. And he said, we never reveal what the Queen tells us. But he went on to say, I think her presence is not just local color, but symbolizes the fact that she is the Queen, not just of the British, but the Canadians. Look at this terminology. Is the Queen a figurehead, or does she have a little bit more power? And is the head of state of the Commonwealth? What happened to him? Many of whose leaders are represented here, South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, Tanzania. So, not deterred, after his press briefing, I went into Jacques Chirac's press briefing. Mr. Chirac, could you please tell me what the Queen told you at dinner? Oh, I cannot tell you. Now, I ask you, who do you think has the real power? Let's talk for a moment about the World Trade Organization. Now, within the World Trade Organization, it's not only the World Trade Organization and what it does internationally, but it is also then regional world trade. And then we get to domestic, where they are organizing us locally. That is called metro government or regional government, and you have it here in Tulsa. So, regional trading zones. The goal is to divide the world up into regional trading zones. You see, one of the problems that historians have had, especially those looking for a world government, is how do you reorganize the world so that you can control it better? You see, Rome disintegrated, aside from the moral reasons, Rome disintegrated because the troops were spread too thin and they couldn't control all the peoples they conquered. So they have come up with this idea of trading zones, and you see them listed there. And they are now dominated by a lead currency, the dollar, the euro, the yen, / renminbi. Just recently, they have added the Chinese renminbi to the yen for the Asian part of the world. Of course, we all know that the dollar floats against these currencies, and it keeps going down. And we don't have time to talk about that. The World Trade Organization was the passage of the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which tore down all the trade barriers between nation states. It was 27,000 plus pages long. Not one total copy of this bill was ever printed. Why? It's 27,000 pages. However, an executive summary about the size of two New York directories was printed.
What will it do? What does it do? First of all, it is a global structure with its own court. It has the power to fine countries. It is the first time since Rome that the businessman and the farmer now competes globally. Let me explain. You see, you and I, no matter what your profession is, we no longer compete with the guy down the street or the lady across the state or the farm in another region. All the barriers are down. You and I now compete globally. We now compete globally. This was an article written by Ron Brown in 1994. He said, "We are present at the creation of a new economic order." Absolutely. All the rules have changed. There are no barriers anymore between the nation states. He went on to say that the tariffs will be partially, completely eliminated for 8 industries, including household, office furniture, pharmaceuticals, farm and construction machinery, that account for presently $37.2 billion in exports. Don't we all know it? He said that it would affect 1.8 million jobs. I think that's the number of jobs that have left. Here are just some headlines talking about what we already know. The next area to come up that the WTO is working on is agriculture. In other words, the ability for third world country agriculture to come in and flood our markets. When erased, the barriers along with the political and financial will do just this. In a borderless world, no one is looking. It provides for global drugs, crime, pornography, kidnapping, and other evil activities. My friend, Dr. Judith Reisman, said this when discussing the effects of world trade. The World Trade Organization and the stripping away of trade barriers also includes the benefits for homosexuals. No one is looking. Open borders provide an opportunity for global homosexuality without notice. They can do all kinds of things. They can do all kinds of things. Now, let's talk a little bit closer to home, not much, but a little bit closer, the free trade areas of the Americas. What is it? It started in 1994. It is equal to the European Union. The U.S. is now joined, for lack of a better word, with 33 other countries of this hemisphere, politically and economically. And it is a public-private partnership. And lastly, our region, 20 years later, meaning 20 years ago, I asked my congresswoman why we needed English as a second language. And she didn't have a really good answer. Why? She didn't want to tell me about this. When Wheaties and oatmeal and Campbell's soup and Pampers are in Spanish and English, it is a reality, isn't it? So how are we going to integrate us? Well, Canada, the United States, and Mexico were integrated in 1994, NAFTA. CAFTA, the Central Agreement, the Central American Free Trade Areas, in 2005. And now what is left is Latin America. If you listen to the news, you will hear that our government is signing individual free trade agreements with individual countries. What are the countries that they're going to have some trouble with? Venezuela, perhaps Brazil. Now we get to our neck of the woods, metro government, regional government, where we live. What we are talking about is basically unelected government over us. Let's take a look at the structure of how the world is now ordered. You have the global level, the federal level, and the state level. That is the reality. And underneath the state, you have the city, the county, etc. You cannot go from the global to the local except the federal allow. You cannot go from the global to the local unless the federal allows and facilitates and gives agreement. Is that not correct? Underneath the state is the city, the county, the township. What we have with metro government or regional government is there is a merger going on with all the little local town, county, municipalities. It's called the devolution of government. This is going on worldwide. I get calls from people all over the world. It's not, there is no representative government here. We're not talking in a constitutional form of government. Richard Nixon issued the executive order 11647 in 1971. He said, "Let us give the people of America a chance, a bigger voice in deciding for themselves those questions that so greatly affect their lives." He divided the United States into 10 regions. You are in region number 6, if you're not aware of that. Congressman John Rarick, God bless him, said this: "Power to the people is a slogan used not only by radical socialists in their plans to communize America, but also by President Nixon in his new American Revolution." You got to call an ace and a spade a spade. Joe Hindman, her book is no longer in print, but I have some copies out there, and I'm only selling them for the cost of reprinting. It is such a powerful, important book that describes the history of regional government. She said, "Metro bloats the administrative fat which is visible in the 1970s at every level of government. Metro, the administrative dictatorship, is violating the constitutional separation of powers principle by overbuilding the executive sector of government. It is the death formula which is destroying American self-government. This is the first time in the history of the American nation that the regional boundaries of the major United Nations chartered domestic programs have been made coterminous under the administrative governance of the chief executive of the United States." In other words, President Nixon said, "I agree with regional government, I agree with the United Nations, and we're going to go along with this and make this part of what we're doing." She further wrote, "Regionalism, the merging of cities, counties, and even states into vast tax grids, lays the foundation for the devious metro format to outsmart the taxpayers. The regional ruling bodies do not represent the citizen taxpayer." In 1967, the regionalization movement in Sovietizing America existed in two prongs. First, planning regions. You should be familiar with this. You should be reading this in your newspaper. And economic development regions. Why? The similarity of regionalization emerging in the USA and in communist Russia is strikingly apparent by comparing Moscow published maps, graphs, and books placed side by side with radical legislation such as Public Law 89-136, approved by the 89th Congress. Regional government. Another researcher said, "To understand regional government, it is necessary to know that metro and regional government are the same. Government of an area or region by a central body of appointed officials who have unlimited and unconstitutional power. If you want to change the structure of America, you take away our right to be represented." You know, the colonists had a tea party because it was taxation without representation. This is just so you know, this is a website on decentralized cooperative programs through the United Nations, all about national regional governments for sustainable development. The Habitat Agenda 1996, and I'm not going to read this, promotes decentralization through democratic local authorities. Here we have an idea of how they're just going to merge the counties and the townships. You can see the colored areas, the different colored areas. That is what they're doing. Executive Order 13083, which was issued in 1998, federalism, redefined the word state so that it includes all levels. It delineates between the Constitution and federalism. It changes sovereign powers granted to states so that federal agencies have control over states. and it allows the president to declare a national emergency, which gives FEMA powers to direct federal, state, and local government versus total control over the communications, power, and food. Alabama, I spoke last year in Alabama on regional government. They have their own regional government. It's called ARC. It's a public organization encompassing a multi-jurisdictional region, and it is tied to local governments and is a non-profit organization. Here you just have a map from their website, the regional map. You can see how they're changing the state. They have business partners. This is a buyout between government and business. Here you have, I even showed this a year ago when I was in Alabama. I said, you're not alone. Look at what Tulsa's doing. All right? How many of you knew about this? How many of you now understand what's happening? A few of you. All right. Stalin said, divide the world into regional groups as a transition stage to world government. Populations will more readily abandon their national loyalties to a vague regional loyalty than they will for a world authority. Later, the regions can be brought all the way into a single world dictatorship. Let's take a look at our last player, the International Criminal Court. This picture was taken by me right before it was voted into existence in Rome in 1998. You talk about chilling, absolutely chilling. The International Criminal Court, it's the first time an international organization transcends sovereignty in order to arrest someone who is an alleged international criminal. This has not happened since Rome. There is no jury, there is no recourse, and you are guilty until proven innocent. The international crimes that someone can be arrested for include crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide. Recently, I saw the movie, the Translator, I think, is that what it's called, The Translator? The Interpreter, The Interpreter. Now, my sister thought it was a great movie, and she wanted me to see it because of the dynamics and fast pace and on and on. And after we got done, she asked me what I thought, and I said, it's an absolutely horrible movie. She was shocked. She didn't understand. I said, this will put in the minds of men, speaking in the minds of men, the idea that we need an international criminal court. It is going to make psychologically the idea, put it psychologically in you, that we need an international criminal court to try horrible people. Guess who some of those horrible people in the future might be? To arrest an international criminal, you need to harmonize laws so that you can search in a foreign country, you can serve an arrest warrant, you can jail and detain, you can extradite to The Hague. All these laws need to be changed. All these rules need to be bent in order to do this. Currently, going on in the world, there's an exchange of police officers and law enforcement academies set up in Budapest and Santiago. There are FBI training centers. There's two of them. And there's 18 joint terrorist forces. We have the International Criminal Court. And we're going to break for 5 minutes. See you in five. Let's take a look at, you know, they say he who owns the gold makes the rules. So with that, let's take a look at the global economics and how the world is ordered. We did all the other major players in the first segment. Now we're going to take a look at the economic players, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which was set up in 1944. What happened when the barriers between the nation states fell? Again, we know that we are a world without borders. We are integrated and interdependent. Again, we talked about the top level here, the power players, IOSCO, the Bank for International Settlements, and the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. However, long before this international level came into play between the nation states and the powers, the barriers between the nation states fell, there were evil men planning to control the monetary system of the world. The concept of a central bank came from Sweden, which was the first to form a private company to lend to the government, the Swedish government, with no fixed time period for repayment. The central banks that were formed started with Sweden in 1688, and then it went to the Bank of England in 1694. Then the Bank of France, there's others in between. And so now you can take a look at the number of central banks. Pretty much most of the countries of the world have a central bank. I want you to see that when Russia spun off their satellite countries in the 90s, they all got a central bank. And surprise, surprise, the most recent central bank is Iraq. That's exactly what you do when you take over a country. You change the entire monetary system and you control it. So Iraq is really under a rock, aren't they? Ha, no pun intended. This is a picture of the Bank of England. This is one of the most powerful central banks in the world. I'm not sure that the United States Federal Reserve is more powerful than this. Why? They control and they offer. They have some of the world's largest gold trading going on from this central bank. The Federal Reserve does not. The Bank of England was birthed in 1694 when William Paterson, he was just, they call him, and I got this from the Bank of England museum. They called him a rogue businessman. Proposed raising 1.2 million British pounds to be lent to the government on the condition that its subscribers, or investors, were incorporated as a stock company. We are talking about the modern corporation here. All right? Now, this is Edward Wessex, otherwise known as Prince Edward. You know, I had always wondered if I were royalty, especially the British royalty, what I would want to do is be a subscriber or an investor in all the central banks of the world. Doesn't that make sense to you? But in order to carry out my thesis, I had to find out if the British royal family had invested in the Bank of England. And I did not know where to get this information. And when I was there, of course, they wouldn't tell me. Somebody called me and said, Prince Edward has this series of movies on Crown and Country. You ought to buy whatever number this one was. And I did. And I was so impressed. Look at this. He's talking about money. He's gotten money from an ATM machine. Do you think he knows what money is really all about? But I thought it was pretty interesting. Now, in setting up a central bank where a private corporation would lend to the government, they would not have any fixed time period to repay, and interest would be paid in perpetuity, forever. This is like a giant credit card that no one pays off the balance, and they're charged interest in perpetuity. It was called the Bank for Perpetual Interest. Here is King William II. He was the largest investor, or one of the largest investors, at £10,000. That was a fair amount of money in those days, considering that they raised 1.2 million. Here is the actual document, and here it says £10,000. And we went from gold to paper, because that's what it signified. Josiah Stamp, director and president of the Bank of England during the 1920s, said this: The modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. How true. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. Take this great power away from the bankers, and all the great fortunes like mine will disappear. And they ought to disappear, for this would be a better and happier world to live in. But if you want to continue the slaves of bankers and pay the cost of your own slavery, let them continue to control money and credit. Every country issues, every central bank in every country issues their own money. If you know, if you take a dollar or a $10, $20, $50, whatever, out of your wallet, it will not say that it is issued by the United States Treasury. It will say Federal Reserve note. In the United States in 1913, through the cunning craftiness of a number of key senators and congressmen, the Federal Reserve Act was passed at 11:45 p.m. December 24th. While all of those God-fearing men, family men, went home to celebrate Christmas, those who wanted a Federal Reserve, a central bank, stayed and voted. They had a quorum. The Federal Reserve Bank was birthed. In the 1990s, the powers of central banks worldwide were harmonized. The Federal Reserve already had these powers, but all the other Federal Reserves, like the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of France, were given the ability to set interest rates. In other words, what do we need Congress for? To set interest rates, that's pretty powerful. What that means is you have an insider group of men that, when they lower interest rates, create a boom in the housing and the stock market. And when they raise interest rates, they have the ability to cause a country to go into recession or depression just by controlling interest rates. And our Federal Reserve already had that. They can intervene in foreign exchange markets. They can set inflation and monetary targets. This is pretty serious. All of the central banks of the world meet at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. Carol Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, said in his book Tragedy and Hope, the apex of financial capitalism was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which they themselves are private corporations. So let's take a look at this picture. Let's just visualize. Every country of the world, that's what those little dots are, they represent a central bank in every country. So let's take a look at Madagascar. I think that's Madagascar. Here you have the whole world monetary system controlled by private corporations. Would it be far-fetched to believe that there is a very powerful inner core group of men who control or who are shareholders of many and most of these corporations? No, not at all. The apex is the Bank for International Settlements. They all meet there. God has been very gracious. I have had the opportunity to cover the last annual meetings at the Bank for International Settlements. You have to be invited. They only hold one public press briefing a year. And they used to give me two questions, but now they've reduced me to one. I guess I'm part of the family. So what do you think happens when most of the countries of the world decide that they're not going to go along with the Bank for International Settlements? What do you think happened when the Asian crisis occurred? Oh, let me go back to that. What do you think occurred? Let me go back one more. The bottom, let's take a look at this. Madagascar, all right? Some little country with a central bank. For whatever reason, they decide they're going to disband their central banking system. They don't want any part of it. They want to go back to where their Congress or their parliament makes the decisions over the financial system. What do you think would happen? All the central banks of the world have a way to bring them back in line. What do? They just put out the word, sell the currency of Madagascar. Sell the currency of Madagascar. In a split second, they can crash any country in the world. They can crash any country in the world. What do you think happened with the Asian financial crises? The World Trade Organization has something called the Financial Services Agreement. And what it calls for is for all countries to lower the barriers in their country so that foreign banks, insurance companies, and brokerage firms can buy up that country's banks, insurance companies, and brokerage firms. Japan, Korea, Malaysia and Thailand said, no, we don't want that. That was the Asian crisis. Several years ago, the Bank for International Settlements took greater power over the whole international infrastructure. And they set up something called the Financial Stability Forum, which said they're going to bring together an interesting mix of very powerful men from the G7. The G7 is the G8 minus Russia. The United States, Germany, Japan, Italy, France, Great Britain, and England. They're going to bring the central bank ministers. Now, those are the people who, you know, head up that private corporation, plus four more from Belgium, Luxembourg, Sweden, and Holland, along with the G7 finance ministers. Those are the secretaries of the Treasury, along with, this is unheard of, NASDAQ, the National Association of Security Commissions, and I also believe the New York Stock Exchange, the regulatory agencies of these countries. They all comprise the Financial Stability Forum, and this group, along with some other organizations, we have IOSCO, the stock exchanges, IAIS, the insurance, the World Bank, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. And they're now looking over the whole global world. What happened to our treasury? What happened to what our treasury is supposed to do? It's basically defunct. These are the men who truly run the world. These are the G7 finance minister and central bankers, including Alan Greenspan. I paid a lot of money for this picture, so I'm going to continue to use it. They don't give these out free. And why did I buy it? Because these are the men who rule the world. Whoever controls the money controls the country. Oh, yes. They all wore a tie. Don't they all look like the Bobbsey twins? The tie had the symbol of the euro, the yen, the dollar, and gold on it. In other words, all the money, they control it. When the world has no borders, you can then put new structures and new rules of the road in place. So let's take a look at what has been going on with our money. First, destroying the value of sound money, adopting an economic philosophy, creating a market-led world, and erasing nation-specific laws. The destruction of the value of money. As you know, Nixon took our dollar off the gold standard. And we went from gold, a tangible, to money, which is fiat. Fiat means there's nothing backing it. Of course, they will say to you that it's the faith in our government that supports the value of the dollar. You will see that that, too, has changed. For the first time in history, the whole monetary system of the world is backed by zero. You know, from Ur of Chaldees, the ancient trading routes, they used cattle, gold, silver, jewels, and expensive clothing. That was their monetary system, a tangible. We're into nothing, which means you can degrade, you can do anything. Rape, rob, and pillage by just changing the value of a country's currency. Two, they adopted an economic philosophy of control. It's called capitalism. Is anybody surprised? Capitalism is an ism. I was sitting at my desk analyzing this, and I said, huh, capitalism, communism, Marxism, socialism. I determined all by myself that when you take out of capitalism honesty, morality, and integrity, you come up with tyranny. What is capitalism? Capitalism needs new markets, new products, new customers, continuously and constantly all the time. I call this Pac-Man capitalism. Joseph Schumpeter An economist who taught at Harvard said, "The essential point to grasp is that in dealing with capitalism, we are dealing with an evolutionary process." In other words, you can't allow capitalism to fall. Capitalism then is by nature a form or method of economic change, and not only never is, but can never be stationary. In other words, in order to keep capitalism from falling, you need to create a, if you need to create a war, so be it. Why? War is a transfer of wealth. War is an economic stimulus. And to go along with capitalism, continuous movement in the market, you need to create a market-led world. What is that? Well, I'm going to show you. In order to get to this, you have to repeal national laws. First, the 1980 Monetary Deregulation Act opened up our borders for investing. Before that, Americans could not invest outside of the U.S. and foreigners could not invest inside. So we now have, from 1980, international and foreign mutual funds. They invest outside of America. Foreigners now can invest here. It eliminated interest ceilings by banks. Now, let me explain what has happened. Up until then, the bank had to pay a minimum amount of interest on savings, and you could not be raped, robbed, and pillaged by paying 15 to 18 to 20% interest on credit cards or mortgages or what have you. When they eliminated this ceiling and this floor that banks could charge and banks could pay, they deregulated it, that's the key word, deregulated it, so that today banks pay 2 to 3% on savings and certificates of deposit, and they charge you 7, 8, whatever in mortgage, and if you're a bad person, you're going to pay 25 to 30% on your credit card. Do you see what they did? And this law did it. But it did something else. When it opened up our borders, $1.9 trillion moves around the world on a daily basis looking for the highest return, the quickest play. Second, they repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which was put in place in 1933. When we had the stock market crash, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed. It separated the functions of banking from the stock market. And it put firewalls in place so that we couldn't have a new 1929 crash. It created what they call financial conglomerates, merging banks, brokerage firms, and insurance companies. In other words, we went back to 1929 in our stock market. Oh, yes. I better do this quick. You know the NASDAQ? It is because they took away all of the firewalls that they were able to create the NASDAQ. That's what it was, because there were no guards against it. We then have the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The two architects were John Maynard Keynes on the right and Harry Dexter White. They were both the same ilk, communists. The World Bank and the IMF were set up to transition world economies to a borderless world. The IMF created its own currency. It's called the Special Drawing Right. In 1974, they adopted guidelines to manage a world on paper. The World Bank sets up stock exchanges around the world. All the third world countries that don't have a stock exchange, they set up. They also have created a global bond market. You know, you can buy McDonald's stock or bonds in French francs. We've had a huge increase in the growth of activity. In 1980, we invested $53 billion outside the U.S., and in 2001, it grew to $5.1 trillion. Similarly, foreigners are investing in the U.S. from $198 billion in 1980 to $20 trillion in 2001. Now, let's go to the importance of a market-led democracy. I was in a G7 finance ministers, and Secretary Snow said, "We recognize that we are so interdependent," there's that word, "that growth in Asia is important to us, and our growth is important to Japan, and Japan's growth is important to the Euro nations, and so on, so that we are all interconnected in ways that one nation's growth feeds and assists in other parts of the globe. The market is central to growth. The value of the dollar is to be determined not by the market and not the strength of policy of government." So what are they saying? The state of the world before market-based democracy, you had government and business, they were separate. Then John Maynard Keynes came along and he said to government, just deficit spend. And the result of deficit spending is that we're $8 trillion in debt. What a great plan. You have all levels of government today are broke, and we have business with the money and jobs. Then Friedrich von Hayek came along, and he said, hey, I've got a solution. All government has to do is sell their assets. I literally call that the plucking of assets. It is. It's the plucking of assets of government. Then Thatcher came along, and Reagan came along, and they said similar things, and they decided that they were going to sell off government. And what did they do? They created something called public-private partnership. Now, you have three words here. It took me a while to figure this out. First of all, what they said is partnership. That's a business arrangement to make money. There are two levels of partners. There are the public levels, which are government, local, county, state, federal, international, foreign, the United Nations. Then you have private. Those are the corporations, the foundations, the labor unions, nonprofits, and even churches. You put them together. All levels of government in there, multinational corporations, and then the NGOs, whether it's the Sierra Club or International Planned Parenthood Federation. Got it? You come together, and you are then able. So a government needs to sell off its water authority. Well, government doesn't want to make it look like it's an outright, you know, transfer of asset, so they bring in business and they bring in the non-governmental organizations, and the bottom line is this is now a new business. It's a business, and they're now going to set the rates for the water authority. So the little old lady who gets her water bill says, I can't afford this. She calls up and they say, hey lady, we're in business to make money. We're not here to service you. What happens? A shift in power from government to business, higher taxation, taxation without representation, and that is the beginning of market-led democracy. So, what is the market? Here is the market. This is the market. Andrew Crockett said, because then I started seeing that all the big boys were talking about the transformation from a government-controlled financial system to a market-led global financial system. That's exactly what Snow said. So here is the market. The market is comprised of stocks, bonds, whether they're corporate or treasury, mortgages, auto loans, credit card paper. What? Wait a minute. What is happening? Mortgages and auto loans. There was a time when banks held your mortgage. If you had trouble, you could go down to Susie Q at the local bank and tell her it's a rough month. She'd say, pay what you can. That no longer happens. Banks are now selling your mortgage, and it's going into the stock market. Who's buying it? The Saudi Arabians, the Russians, the Japanese. Japanese are the biggest buyer of mortgages. And now the Chinese. Credit card paper. Do you think that the banks are holding your Visa card? You know why they're charging 30% interest rates? Because it's going into the market and they want to entice investors. Mutual funds, derivatives, commodities, futures, and now currencies. You see, government is being completely sold off so that it is no longer government that supports the value of their own currency. It is the stock market. Everything is going into the market. So how do you transfer wealth? You skim off the top. It's called market adjustments. or highs and lows. It's facilitated by central banks, and he who has the most shares wins. Now, if you'll give me just another 2 seconds or 2 minutes, let me talk about the coming global stock exchange. It's basically here. This is a diagram. You can find this in my book, The United Nations Global Straitjacket. And here it shows all the different stock markets of the world. In the last 10 years, all the different stock exchanges have been going public. That means that they now can you can buy shares of these stock exchanges on the stock exchange. Most recently, so we now have, let me just say that while it's now possible to buy stock on the stock exchange, at the same time, regionally, there's that word again, regionally, you were having all of the stock exchanges go into a regional stock. So Oslo and Stockholm, Copenhagen, Helsinki are now part of the Nordic exchange. They have one exchange for the region. With the European Union, you have the Euronext, and all the individual stock exchanges are now merging. The London Stock Exchange is independent. They went public. Philadelphia is still a private corporation. Amex is to go public next year. The NASDAQ went public 3 years ago. The New York Stock Exchange just went public. And the president said that in the future, they expect they are going to make transatlantic alliances. The New York Stock Exchange expects to be involved in takeovers, including in Europe, after completing its transformation into a public company. That took place in March. And so we now are at a point whereby the NASDAQ just bought 18% of the London Stock Exchange. That doesn't mean that there's not room for the New York. The New York could still buy the other remaining 82% if they can. Or the London Stock Exchange might want to buy the Euronext. So stay tuned. The coming global stock exchange. And in the meantime, they have been setting up all the support systems for this. They now have, did you know that they've been moving towards a global accounting system? And every country, one by one, has been switching. China just switched to a global accounting system. They have other things that support a global stock exchange. Custody system, settlement system, a clearing system, a customs agreement. The goal is to make the stock exchange like global telecommunications. I don't think I have to explain that to you. And so, what does a global stock exchange need to facilitate commerce? It needs a global currency. There were some geniuses, including Paul Volcker, who met in 2003 in Italy to talk about the possibility of maybe a global currency. Currently, between 1999 and 2001, 97% of all bonds are issued in five currencies. I had an opportunity to interview Paul Volcker, who is the taller man on the left, who used to be the Federal Reserve chairman. And I interviewed him a couple years ago. And I asked him what he saw for the future. And he said, well, for the long term, but it's a long ways off, if we are going to be successful in a globalized world, we should have an international currency. And I said, like the special drawing right? And he said, no, it would be more than that. And I said, like what? Well, when Paul Volcker at 7 feet turns his back on somebody who's 5 feet, the interview is over. In 2005, the Bank for International Settlements talked about possibly moving towards a single currency or perhaps a regional currency block. And so I asked the general manager, Dr. Knight, about it. And he said, the question you ask is not an easy one about regional currencies. I think that movements to a regional currency are a long way off. Not really. 6 months later, they issued a working paper that said, guess what? We must possibly go to a gold standard, that's a bunch of garbage, to a single international currency or maybe a regional currency. So I think in the future, as we take a look at what's going on, especially with oil, oil has been sold in dollars since 1973 and 74. There are countries who are saying, I want off the dollar, and if I want to buy oil, I want to buy it in euros. I think in order to save the American economy, which is dependent on selling oil in dollars in order to keep us from a total crash. We have to switch to, I think, a basket of currencies. So that's my prediction. Stay tuned. And it's time for lunch. Because of our time together, we're going to go through Agenda 21, and then I would like to end with a spiritual dimension. With regard to the spiritual dimension, we're going to go, I'm just going to close out one screen and go into another to get to the spiritual dimension that I have prepared. What I'm about to say spiritually does not mean that we should be robots and allow and just say to somebody who takes our land, I forgive you. That's not it. It does not pertain to anything in the future. It pertains to us and our heart response to others. I'm not talking about specifically world government, okay? So with that, I would like to begin, and we are going to discuss conventional warfare versus spiritual warfare. We had the Phoenicians, and they knew how to conquer by the sea. Then there was Alexander the Great, and he did it by horse. Jeremiah 8:16 says, "The snorting of his," meaning Babylonian, "horses was heard from Dan. The whole land trembled at the sound of the neighing of his strong ones, for they are come and have devoured the land and all that is in it, the city and those that dwell therein." What am I saying here? There was a time in warfare when you could hear the armies coming. You could hear, you knew, you could feel the danger. But that is no longer. War has changed. Yes, there was Hitler. Yes, there were the concentration camps. Yes, there was Nagasaki. Do you think those people knew 2 seconds or 2 minutes before that bomb was dropped what was going to happen? No. This is something I'd like to read to you about the Soviet occupation of Poland. This is what we call communism, fast and quick. On September 17, 1939, at 2:15 a.m., the Polish ambassador to the USSR was summoned to the Soviet Foreign Office. There, M. Potemkin read him a note to the effect that the Soviets regarded the Polish government as disintegrated and the Polish state as having, in fact, ceasing to exist. Accordingly, the Soviet government had ordered its troops to cross the Polish border and take, under their protection, the life and property of the population of Western Ukraine and the Western White Russia. There are different kinds of warfare being waged today, worldwide, but also for the assets and the soul of America, because we live here, and for the world. The war of the soul is being waged on the international level and on the spiritual level. And here we're going to talk the spiritual level. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light, it was good. God divided the light from darkness. And God called the light day. And the darkness he called night. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. And let it divide the waters from the firmament." And God called the firmament heaven. And God said, "Let the waters and the heaven be gathered into one place, and let dry land appear." And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herbs yielding seed, and fruit trees yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, an herb yielding seed. And God said, "Let there be lights to divide the day from the night, and let there be seasons." And God made the two great lights, and the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creatures that has life, the fowl that it may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven." And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and he made male and female. And God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish and the sea, the fowl and the air, and every living creature that moves on the earth. And let them have dominion over, well, I always like to repeat. That is until Agenda 21. What is Agenda 21? What did it do? What does it mean? Up until 1992, from the beginning of time, the world was ordered under a Christian worldview. Man had dominance over the earth. That's what the word said. That's what was taught. That's what was believed. Up until 1992, when the Rio Earth Summit was unveiled publicly for people on planet Earth. That worldview is pagan, based on the worship of the earth goddess Gaia. And it basically says that the earth has dominance over man. This is a perversion, an inversion of Genesis 1. The values of America are being radically changed. The UN has succeeded in altering and changing God's word. Agenda 21, what is it? As I showed you, 1,300 pages of rules and taxes to control every aspect of life on planet Earth. Who went to the Rio Earth Summit in 1992? 179 governments, not all the governments. World leaders, business leaders, scientists, and key non-governmental organizations involved in the environment, reducing the population, and social planning. Let me just say here that when we start taking a look at Agenda 21 and what it calls for, a complete reordering of the earth, why would businessmen care? Because this is one of the most diabolical marketing schemes and plans in the history of the world. You're going to take people from the car or the gas car and put them in the electric car. Think of all the new business and what people would have to buy. You're going to take them from the car and put them in trains. Guess what? Some company's going to provide all those trains. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is a major squeeze the Charmin. But besides being a marketing plan, and that's why the business were there, it is completely, as you see, diabolical. It is reordering the earth. The last time the earth was reordered was when Eve ate the fruit. And you and I will agree that that was pretty major. So, Agenda 21 has to do with sustainable development, the Biological Diversity Treaty, which is known as smart growth, and two areas that we're not going to talk about, the forest and climate change. What does it say? First, the earth cannot feed and sustain 8.5 billion people. People are destroying the earth, so we need to be contained. That's smart growth. Animals have more value than people. They need to roam freely. The shoe's on the other foot, you see. Or should I say the shoe is on the wrong hoof. Built into the 1,300 pages is a socialistic transfer of wealth. The have to the have-nots. There is a reordering of property rights and individual rights. The elimination of representative government. So when we take a look at what this means, we're going to see that over and over again, they have these things built into the entire agenda, including regional government. I just want to show you, the United Nations had their first major global environmental conference in 1972. And so I have highlighted in red the major environmental laws that we started to see being passed in the early 70s. So you get the feel. Now let's take a look at it this way. And you can see, basically, when you look at, this is about 1972, just take a line straight up. Do you see what's happening? Rules, regulations, taxes, fines, penalties. This is a page taken from a book called Ecosystem Management, Status and Potential. It was a 3-day workshop convened by CRS, which is it has something to do with the government, in 1994. And I almost fainted when I saw this. And here is their diagram. We're going to go from dualism, which is based on traditional Christianity, and Cartesian perspectives, to, they call it holism, an ecological perspective, where man is just all part of the agenda, nothing special. I guess you could call us disposable. What is sustainable development? Sustainable development says there are too many people on planet Earth and the population must be reduced. The Earth has, the Earth's resources must be preserved and conserved. The United Nations is the only organization in a position to do this. Amazing, isn't it? We have all these problems, and guess what? The UN is there to solve them. So let's take a look at there are too many people on the planet. So how are we going to reduce the population of the planet? Abortion. This is what got me interested in what was going on in the school system. Abortion. Condom distribution. What? I remember the first time I did a radio show, and it was my radio show. I used to have a radio show. And I was interviewing a man, and we were talking about what was going on in the school system. I was terribly embarrassed to talk about things that you never discussed publicly. You just sort of whispered, you know? And now we're shouting them from the rooftops. We have come a long way. Homosexuality. Why would we want to promote homosexuality? They do not procreate. They adopt, but they don't procreate. Euthanasia. The right to die with dignity. You'll see where they're going in a minute. Dr. Jacqueline Kaysen from Humboldt University did a little bit of math. And her math says that if you put all the 8.5 billion people of the world into the state of Texas, they can live on 1,200 square feet. End of story. End of story. What we're being told is a lie. It has been adopted by most countries worldwide, including the U.S. It is supported by the Group of Eight, an expansion of the Group of Eight called the Group of 20, and other major political groups. It's supported by transnational corporations. You know how much money they make on condoms? That's a lot. It's an organizing principle of the United Nations. I was sitting at my desk, and I was asking the Lord to show me where sustainable development came from. And my reasoning went like this. Is it found in our Constitution? No. What is the opposite of our Constitution? The Russian Constitution. I buy used books. I love to go in a used bookstore. In fact, I bought a few books here. I don't know how I'm going to carry them all back. You know, you get a lot of good material in those used bookstores. So I highly encourage you all to frequent your local bookstores. You will find a lot of truth there that is being discarded. I had just bought an old ratted up book on the Russian Constitution. I hadn't read it yet. So I decided to sit down. I didn't have any coffee. I just thought I'd do it straight lace. I got as far as Chapter 2, Article 18. In the interests of the present and future generations, the necessary steps are taken in the USSR to promote and make scientific, rational use of the land and its mineral and water resources, and the plant and animal kingdoms, to preserve the purity of air and water, ensure reproduction of natural wealth, and improve the human environment. Does that sound like sustainable development to you? It does to me. So, you know, you have to go to the source. I did an interview with a gentleman by the name of Jeb Brugman. He runs a major environmental NGO. The acronym is ICELI, I-C-E-L-I. So I asked him to define sustainable development for me. And he said, well, he says, we have the socialist concern for development, and we have the capitalist concern for development, and now we're merging them into sustainable development. Let me go through that one more time. Sustainable development is a merger between capitalism and socialism, which is communism. What does sustainable development say? The soul has no value. You can't get any more wicked and evil and against God than this. Because it is life and breath and the soul that we live and move and have our being in Him. Sustainable development says you and I are responsible for the pollution of the planet and that we are subordinate to all other living creatures. I have been amazed in the 12 years that I have covered global meetings because at every turn, I'm learning about things that go against common logic, our way of life, our way of thinking, the Constitution, just the Bible. And so, I was reading, I don't know what you read, but I read documents like the Fourth Women's Conference on Beijing. So I was reading this document, and I kept seeing this phrase, family dependency ratio. And I thought, wonder what that is. See, the United Nations never defines anything. So I started a little list. And I was trying to figure out if I could figure it out. And so I came up with this definition. You have 102 South Main Street, anywhere in the United States, anywhere in the world. Mom and dad live there. They produce. They have jobs. They produce. Baby and grandparent live there. They do not produce. They consume. What the United Nations, well, actually, the IMF World Bank has been working on, and this is being used. There are non-governmental organizations now going to people's homes to show them how much of the Earth's resources they're wasting and how to do it more ecologically. And so the IMF World Bank has come up with ways to determine how much you produce at work and how much you produce at home. Then they want to subtract how much you consume. They can get it from your gas bill, your light bill, your Visa, your credit card, your grocery. You know, you now get, even the grocery knows how much you are spending. Subtract that out. They come up with, are you adding back to the Earth's resources or are you subtracting from the Earth's resources? In my whole life, I never thought that I would ever have to give account for how much toilet paper I use. And my husband does complain. I just somehow use a lot. But I think, to be honest with you, I'm taking what I read and it's just coming out the right end. That's a spur of the moment. That's a, I've been enlightened as I'm up here speaking. Well, you know, I'll have to use a little bit more of the Earth's resources. But anyway, family dependency ratio says, what is your usefulness as a person? Do you produce or do you just consume? Are you adding back to society, which would be volunteerism? Now, let me tell you what I think about volunteerism. I think it is very possible at some point in time, I hope never, that somebody will take a look at my figures, how much I produce, how much I consume. And if I come up on the minus end, they just may determine that I need to do 20 hours of volunteerism in the community. All right? If volunteerism, see, our kids don't understand definitions of words because the schools are all mandating volunteerism. If you have to volunteer, it isn't volunteerism. It's slavery. It is highest and best use. Your highest and best use as a person. Which brings us into eminent domain. Kelo versus New London passed a year ago June. They said private property can be taken when it has a higher or highest and best use. So, what does this do? It violates the Constitution and personal property rights. It says nothing is sacred. Everything now can be denominated to highest and best use. Human beings become a number without any value of their own. It's an extension of Agenda 21. And all of our personal rights are subject to highest and best use. It degrades the meaning of human life. So let's take a look at what's going on now with what the Bible says. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. I will be covering next month the UN Treaty on the Lawful Uses of Outer Space, my first one. So what in the world do you think is up there? How do we know what's up there? How do we know what they're doing? I do know that satellites know where I'm going. I have an international cell phone. All I have to do is turn it on. I do know that there is a reason for why we had to get lead out of our paint. It wasn't because it created any problem in us. It was so the satellites could see better. I have been told by scientists that satellites can measure the quality and what's in trees and determine if they have the right bugs or not. I have been told by those same scientists that they can measure the land anywhere in the world 3 inches deep just by satellite. So what else can they see? And God said, let there be firmaments in the midst of the waters. That brings us to the American Heritage Rivers Act, passed in 1998. Now, we're going to take a look at what's happening here in the United States and how everything is being buffered, everything is being zoned. The yellow represents highly buffered areas around our rivers. These are the rivers and the streams that are part of the American Heritage Rivers Initiative. It only took one congressman to opt out and write the president that he did not want his state or the rivers in his state to be part of it. We have one, he tells me, or tells us, is very conservative, and he refused to write the letter. So since I live outside of Washington, D.C., the Potomac is part of this. There is a Clean Water Initiative, part of Agenda 21, that calls for the setting aside of 2 million miles of buffer strips, and you can see the yellow becoming bigger, protecting waters from agricultural runoff by the year 2002. This would be equal to the entire state of Nebraska or South Dakota. So let's take a look here. We have highly regulated buffer zones in yellow, and we have what we call core wilderness in red, which has little or no use. So here is a map. You can just sort of see where the rivers are across the U.S., so you can get an idea of what's going to turn yellow. This is a diagram done by a lady friend, Linda Liotta, on the structural setup of the American Heritage Rivers Act. It eliminates the Congress and the Constitution, which appears to be the modus operandi in society today. And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together in one place and let the dry land appear. And God called the dry land earth and gathered together the waters he called seas. So let's take a look at biological diversity. What is biological diversity? It's called smart growth. It's really the demise of the farmer. So this is all these colored pictures that you're seeing are done by Dr. Michael Kaufman, who has been studying biological diversity for years. They are a simulation based on extensive research as to what the government intends. And what you have here is the core area is red, where nobody can live. That would be like Yellowstone National Park. The yellow is a highly regulated use. Green is normal use. So you can count how many green places you see. This is called smart growth. You and I will be herded into designated smart growth areas. My state, Maryland, was the first state to pass the Biological Diversity Treaty under smart growth. You have it here in Tulsa. Now, how do they end up adding to these areas? Well, the IUCN, which is an ecological non-governmental organization, very radical, very, very evil, set up different levels of red areas. Your strict nature reserves, which is called the wilderness, your national parks, national monument and national landmarks, habitat and species management, protected landscapes and seascapes, managed resource protected areas. All of these are red. Some of them are yellow. So I was trying to figure out how they add to it. So I was doing some research, and here's the history of House bills and resolutions dealing with the environment, the 103rd Congress. And so as I went through the House bill, and then if it became law, it's on the right-hand side. So the House bill's on the left where you see the color, and if you see a number next to it, it became law. So you can see, for example, how this was a House bill, it became law, it added to highly restricted use. So now we can see what is happening here. Smart growth says that, and I'm not going to go into it, but it says land use planning is comprehensive, integrated, and regional. Public, private, and nonprofit sectors collaborate on growth and development issues to achieve mutually beneficial outcomes. Urban centers and neighborhoods are integral parts of a healthy regional economy. And then lastly, it goes into how you can get transportation options. Those are the high-speed rail systems, the light rail systems that I told you about. You can make a lot of money on them. Ben Franklin said, there are three ways for a nation to become wealthy. One is by war and the taking away of wealth of another by force. Two is by trade, which to make a profit requires something cheap. Three is by agriculture, where by planting a seed, you create a new wealth as if by a miracle. I am a city girl, but I plant 3 tomato plants a year. I know you're really impressed. And even I was able to understand if I plant 3 tomato plants, I can get multiple tomato plants that cost me hardly anything except for the cost of the 3 plants. And I can have them all through the summer. Versus having to pay $2.50 for a little few couple tomatoes every time I want them. Well, you farmers are going to laugh at me, but I did some math. But I do know that whoever controls the land controls the food. So here is my renewable multiplication. Catherine Rott's husband did it because it was above my head. You take 1 stalk of wheat, you get 15 kernels. 1 acre of land is 43,560 feet. You can plant 72 kernels per square foot, which means in a square foot, you will have 72 kernels times the 43,500 square feet, and you get 3,136,320 new plants in 1 acre. 15 kernels per plant times 3,136,320 gives you 47,044,800 kernels per acre. If 1,000 kernels yields 1 loaf of bread, you will get 47,000 loaves per acre. 160 acres, you could use 1,600 acres, but, 160 acres sounds like a lot of land to me. 7,520,000 loaves of bread. Can you imagine, given the acreage that's in farming today, how many trillions of loaves of bread we can make? The number of U.S. farms in the U.S. In 1910, there were about 6,500,000. By 2000, it's 2 million or less. Here in Oklahoma, in 1910, it went from 190,000 farms to 90,000 or less. If you eradicate the farmer, you starve the people into submission. What is smart growth? What is biological diversity? Now, do you see how the microchipping of animals falls into this diabolical Orwellian agenda? What will smart growth do to the value of your land? I can tell you in the state of Maryland that smart growth, we had smart growth in 1997. In 2000, the stock market crashed. Interest rates went down to 45-year lows. So we had a little lead-in time. The house that I had that I sold that did not appreciate after living in it for 10 years, I sold it in 1998, and it doubled the following year. Now, because of the fact that Maryland is a dynamic area and Maryland is a smart growth area, and because interest rates went down so people could buy more house with less money or less interest, you know, that kind of thing, that same house, I sold it for $205. The following year, it was up to $305, and today it's selling for $650. And we're talking a 40-year-old home now. You have smart growth. Maywood Park in Oklahoma City, they want to reinvent your morning commute. Look at that. Get them out of the car and on a bicycle. How many of you are going to ride a bike? Mm-hmm. I see. They are suggesting brownstones, townhomes in the downtown, and they even have a light rail metro system planned. I see sustainable development and biological diversity. I also see something else, and you forgive me, but I keep seeing pyramids all over the place. So you just move that triangle, and you get a pyramid. And the triangle represents a comprehensive approach to creating the urban environment for Oklahoma City. In other words, we no longer have value, and we no longer have dominance over planet Earth. This is biological diversity at its finest. The question now is, as we go to the last segment that we are going to discuss, is what is our response? How will we, I got to go back up here, how will we live in world government? How do we live in world government? This is what I'm going to share with you. Basically, a personal testimony. How do we confront evil? How do we stand in the midst of this diabolical agenda? You see, what I have concluded is you and I can read history books, and we can read about what happened 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 100 years ago, 200, 300, 1,000 years ago. We have, for the most part, no idea what those people did. We have no idea how they lived. We have some idea how they stood, because the Word of God is still prevalent, and we have it. All right? But now, it is our turn. It is our time. Can we oppose this in our own strength? No. It has to come from within. It has to be a spiritual response. Luke 22:23-34 says, "And there were also two other malefactors led with him to be put to death. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, there they were crucified with him and the malefactors, one on the right and the other on the left. Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Romans 8:1-2 says, "There is therefore no condemnation to them which are in Christ Jesus, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death." Now, when we're talking about the Spirit, we're talking about the Holy Spirit within. When we're talking about the flesh, we're talking about the flesh. That was brilliant, Joan. Galatians says, "This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you will not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. But if you be led of the Spirit, you are not under the law." It is true. You and I are confronted constantly with spiritual warfare. Our flesh, which sort of likes sin and chocolate chip cookies and things like that, and the Spirit, and we're constantly in this battle. Now the works of the flesh are which are manifest are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like. Of which I tell you before, as I have also told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Now, you're sitting there and you're saying, well, I don't do 90% of those. That's fine. I don't do 90% of those. Galatians 5:19-24. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-sufferings, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. They that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. Question. How do we go from anger and fear and even murder to peace and joy? We do it through forgiveness. The first verse I read. That forgiveness, we have to extend forgiveness to others who have hurt us. Now, I am not talking about the future. I want you to just freeze in time where you are in your life. I'm talking about the person who slapped you up good, the person who told you you were ugly, the one who told you they were fat, the father who didn't know the difference between a little bit of instruction and beating. You know, all these things that happen to us. This is what I'm talking about. Because it happens to all of us. It's all part of living in a fallen world. It is, how do we deal with that? It is the same forgiveness that Jesus gave to those on the cross that we need to extend to them that harmed and hurt us. You say, hey, I didn't come here for this. Yes, you did. Mm-hmm. Man is comprised of three parts: body, soul, and spirit. It's taken me a long time to figure this out, and there are people who have helped me greatly. God resides in the spirit man. When we ask Jesus to come into our life, to forgive us of our sin, he comes into the spirit side of us. However, we have the soul. What about how we live with those hurts, those wounds, those rejections? Believe me, I've had a whole lot of them, a whole boatload full of them. How do you live? Well, guess what? The body has the mind, and the body recalls. And the mind recalls, okay? Because it's part of the flesh. The mind recalls, and you say, oh, I remember that. My mama, oh, it was awful. It was really awful, you know. She just took all my self-esteem, made me feel like I was worthless. The soul has the will and the emotions. That's what hurts. That has the scars. How do you heal those scars and those wounds? Well, those hurts and wounds and rejections and the victimization lead to fear and anger and jealousy, secret sins, all kinds of things. We already mentioned those in Galatians. They produce walls and hardness, promiscuous behavior, fear, low self-esteem. Part of it is that when we are so full of this gunk, we cannot see how God sees us. Jeremiah says, he formed us before he saw us. He knew us. He saw us in our mother's womb. Jeremiah 31 says, he loves us with an everlasting love, no matter what you've done. John 15:15 says that we're friends of God. Ephesians 1:4 says we're chosen in Christ before the foundation of the world. Philippians 4:7 says God's peace guards our hearts and our minds. What I have found from my own personal life is that while I was full in my emotion and my mind with all these things that had hurt me, I couldn't think about anything else. Spiritually, I was existing. God is good. It was the spirit man that was maintaining everything that he was asking me to do. He does not discard us. He just wants us to be free. When we are able to recognize our emotional hurts. And believe me, I didn't think I had any. I didn't know that I had them. I didn't know that I was walking around emotionally damaged. You have to identify them and give them to Jesus. Ask him to reveal. It took me years to do this. Oh, Lord, I remember when this happened. Lord, please forgive that person. Help me to forgive that person. All right? Ask him to forgive, to help you to forgive them, those who have hurt you, and then you forgive them, taking on that hurt like Jesus did at the cross for us. Now let's go back to Romans 8. There is therefore no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus, look at that, has made me free from the law of sin and death. What am I saying here? When you can forgive all these people, you have freedom and joy because you can now build up and understand what it means to walk in the Spirit. Now, do you think Jesus put us here to adorn the earth? He's got the earth. He's got the stars and the trees and the firmament and the oceans and the birds and the bees and the beautiful flowers. He just doesn't need us to adorn this earth. We are here to stand in the gap. How will we oppose such evil? You cannot oppose it, like I found out, with a lot of gunk up here and here. You have to have the cross and God's forgiveness so that you have total freedom. Because when you do that, you have such a freedom and joy in your life. It doesn't make any difference if you're in world government. It doesn't make any difference if you're put in prison. It does not make any difference if somebody takes all your assets through rape, rob, pillage, whatever, smart growth, eminent domain. It doesn't make any difference because the freedom that we are to have in Jesus Christ transcends all of these things. I wouldn't tell you this. I wouldn't share it if it wasn't for the fact that I've been through this. It took me 6 years. It took me 6 years and a lot of tears to clean out all those stuffy hurts and wounds. And you know what? I have such joy. I have such peace. I have the peace that passes understanding. So what is world government all about? World government is all about Jesus. It is all about Jesus. Somebody said, give me some answers. This is the answer. Are you lonely? It's Jesus. Are you hurting? It's Jesus. Are you poor? It's Jesus. Are you between a rock and a hard place? It's Jesus. Do you need to go up against evil and you're not quite sure how to do it? It's Jesus. It's Jesus. It's Jesus. It's Jesus. And I want to thank you. And I want to thank Kate and her organization for bringing me in. I want to thank you for listening and for receiving. And I pray that God will allow you and the Holy Spirit will reign in your hearts and bring back things that you need to recall. And that, if you need to determine how you need to proceed spiritually. I have some tapes out there, some CDs from my pastors that are free for you to take. Take them, just ask for them. I have a little booklet called A Study of the Mind. You need more? I've got a whole list of books that I can share with you. Give me a call at the women's group, 301-371-0541. Thank you, and God bless you.